Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week, ladies and gentlemen. Hopefully you can get your daily dose of conspiracy and comedy, and make sure you share out those archives with all your friends and family. You can join us in the chat room at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, or if you go into the NSA search engine, Google knows where to find it. You search Vinnie Eastwood Chat. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. Today we have a somewhat fabulous guest. His name is Bernard Mendez from BernardMendez.com and UFOQNA.com. And he used to work for the Nixon administration, but we won't hold that against him. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So would you please, we want to kind of cover your background in the Intel community and your previous work experience in the first segment, so that people will become familiar with who you are and what you do. And also, you're kind of an attaché at the moment for Andrew Breshago, because you have been capable of now corroborating his previously uncorroborable story of time travel and jump rooms and teleportation and all of that. So firstly, Bernie, just let us know a little bit of your background and history.
Very good. Yes, I'm collaborating Andrew. Many people approached me about Andrew prior to speaking with him when he was on Coast to Coast. I heard him on Coast to Coast, and what he said sounded very familiar. So, and then after I heard him on Coast to Coast, I sent him an email through his website, and then he called me and we began talking. We talked several times. One time we talked all night. He couldn't believe he found me. He's sure it's me, because we had, during the jump rooms time, he was in the West Coast. I came from the East Coast, and then I went to the West Coast. We had several incidences which we discussed, and nobody can make up a fantastic story like that from coast to coast. We hadn't seen one another in many, many years. What led up to that was I was actually training with this equipment that Andrew was discussing in somewhat detail, though I don't exactly agree with all his theories and all his details, but that's another story. When I was young, very, very young, I had an incident when I was 2 years, 6 months, 3 days old, according to the official naval report about me. It was the naval board that I faced. There were 15 Navy people there, including doctors and whatnot. When I went through this elaborate testing, and I qualified. So, and they knew my complete medical history. The reason why I want to make that clear is because people have raised questions about my medical history from time to time, and they say, well, I know something about you, and these people, the Navy, didn't know about this. I says, I find that hard to believe, because I went through this very elaborate training, and the secret was greater than the atomic bomb at the time. And there was nothing about me they didn't know. And if there was something they wanted to know, I usually found myself with someone with a very large needle who was going to stick it into my arm, and where I was going to fall asleep for a while when they would start talking to me in my sleep. So there's really nothing much they don't know about me. So, like I say, I'm here to collaborate, Andrew, and I was being training at a very young age. I was about 6 years old when I made my actual, I don't know if you call it a jump. The equipment was very primitive then. It's very close to what Andrew was saying. I was like in a very small area, like being in a very, like a clear plastic tube, like expands like a slinky, like a big sling, and you go flying out of it. And then sometimes you came flying back. And I used to do that. I used to do it quite well. And the reason why I did it with young people was because they actually tried, and Andrew mentioned older people, and they didn't do too well, because they came back and then they became oxygen starved. They didn't know much about not hypothermia, hypoxia, where, you know, you go into a very low oxygen environment, or an environment that has a high concentration of CO, carbon monoxide, or carbon dioxide, where you have to learn how to hold your breath for a long period of time? Or there's this differential that can't be accounted for time-wise, and this is what Andrew's going on about. So, for instance, it's been noted from time to time, and I've had it happen to me myself, where the time you start at and the time you return, say, is 1 hour. But if the time you actually experience something, maybe 10 minutes. Now, how this happens, we don't know, and vice versa. For instance, if you take two watches, synchronized, take one which you wanted to jump if it worked, and one left behind, the watch, when you get back, it's going to say 1 hour has passed. But if you look at your watch, you took what you wanted to jump, it will say that 10 minutes has passed. Now, how this is possible, I don't know. Maybe there's something wrong with the watch. But these things have happened from time to time. That's what Andrew was talking about, this time travel business. So that's what I was doing with a very small device that was in its primitive phase in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and then I was about 5 or 6 years old. These devices are very difficult to get to work. They're very elaborate devices. But the Navy was doing this full-time in the Philadelphia yard when World War II started. And then they coincidentally moved to Camp Hero and a couple other locations. And apparently this was due to the fact that in the Philadelphia yard, and when I was negotiating at the areas with space aliens themselves, and I had given them, because we didn't know what they were talking about. They claimed we were intruding into their space, and we didn't know exactly what they meant by that. Maybe it's because we went to the moon, but they didn't seem that was a consideration. So we gave them, I came down there to give them camera equipment and photographic equipment, which we gave them, a big trunk with 2 or 3 cameras and 3 or 4 photographic equipment, film equipment, and you know, a lot of film and whatnot. And they came back fairly quickly, and they showed us a very large cylinder. Well, actually, it wasn't very large. It's something about, I guess, about 4 feet long by about 2.5 feet wide. It was one piece, and a couple of the other cylinders were bolted. And I took this back to my superiors. We call them lateral moves. The people that worked there, I said, will someone explain to me what they're talking about? They have a picture of what they're talking about. I want details about this immediately. And it took about 2 hours. And someone said that was a cylinder that was used during this experiment they had with the space alien technology that they were experimenting with in the Philadelphia yard, which they eventually moved. I says, well, not for nothing, do you know where it went? Because the space aliens are complaining that this cylinder flew out into their space, did some damage, and they traced it back, you know, to the area not far from the Philadelphia yard, if not precisely where it was launched from. It's a very peculiar device that launches these things, which led up to these jump rooms. And as time went on, we found out that these jump rooms that we were doing was going into some sort of dimensional. Now, I've been trained in physics. I've got college credits in physics. I don't have a degree or doctorate in physics, but I'm close to it, not that far away. And I'm respected by my professors, and that's all that really counts to me. We opened a door without being invited and without being escorted into an area of space and disturbed a lot of space aliens. Now, through the negotiations, they were of the opinion that we would eventually have done this anyway. So the way, and I sensed it right away, or I got them to say something to that effect. I said, well, could you escort us to these areas? Now, there were a lot of questions. The military had priority over these matters, and Senate subcommittees had a lot of questions at that point. from what we were able to determine, they were going to allow us to see things that we could relate to, things that would look familiar to us, or things that we could understand. So namely, that boiled down to 153 areas, or slots, as the astronauts put them. With the physicists, see, when I saw the physicists were physicists, astronomers were astronomers, and now they combined it to what they call them astrophysicists, came up with a term. And now it's not the multiverse, as many people have stated on George Norrie, it's the fourth. They're going to call it the fourth, and that's it. You know, there's a lot of people claim there's a lot of different dimensions and different quantum physics dimensions. It's all going to be the fourth dimension. Whether it's invisible, hollow Earth, out in space in a slot, or hollow moon, or hollow Mars, or elevations to Mars and moon, or hollow elevations to the planet we live on, however you want to put it, they're going to call it the fourth, because it's getting very, very complicated. So, through negotiations, and I know there was a lord there from the British side of things. I'm trying to remember his name. They call him a duke. I didn't know what a duke was. Apparently some sort of title in the British Empire, who was talking with them. And when this was all coming about, I got very tired. I had been up a very long time. So I decided to go to sleep, and I laid down. And then they woke me up maybe like an hour later, and they began talking about all this. So my opinion was, when I went to the West Coast jump room, that these space aliens would make adjustments to the jump rooms. And they did give us some peculiar things. Andrew was mentioning one. And I don't know what we could do with them, but there are people screwing around with them ever since. We're going to be in these areas, and we're going to make modifications to the existing technology we had at the time, either from crash ships or retrieve ships or whatever, and try and show us what is now termed this sector of space we live in, or points beyond, or who would ever accept us. It's kind of like a diplomatic thing. It's kind of like you have diplomatic relations with a country, and you send people there, and they say, we do not accept these people, and they send them back. Now, their reasoning behind this is that we contaminate the places we go to, and that we could start epidemics. So they really don't like us going off on our own. But the alternative, and the word alternative is quite, was classified at one time, was for them to take us and was for them to escort us. And that was my plan. I don't know if anybody else will claim it, but they can go right ahead. And it was beginning to work. Now, I went from the jump rooms and then down at, I didn't know the term at the time. They call it, I know it as a deuce, but they call it El Dulce. More and more aliens began talking to us. And one of the things we tried to explain to them is to learn how to speak English, which they really didn't understand. And I had a big argument with a lot of people about that. There was an opinion we should not tell them anything. I said, and I did my homework, all the missionaries that went out to different parts of the world, Christopher Columbus on his explorations, Lewis and Clark on their explorations, all had a very common problem. Even the United States, when we first established relations with Japan, or what is known at the time, the Japans and China, was that we had a language barrier. In fact, it took many years for the Japanese, even during the course of the war, they were asking questions as to what these words meant and as to what we were doing with particular activities that we have. So that was quite a common theme. Now, sometime later, around the time of the Mona Lisa incident, and Mona Lisa, you can punch it up, Apollo, Mona Lisa, I'll leave it at that for now. They began talking to us. This is across the board about the transmissions, and it took time to narrow it down. What they were talking about is TV transmissions, mainly. Now, there was a lot of radio transmissions that they were talking about. We didn't know that. And for some reason, I don't know why anyone ever asked them these particular questions, they assumed that the transmissions from the TV were real and that they weren't fictitious and they were actual events. And they were basing their relationship from about the 1950s through 1968 or so on these transmissions and had made plans accordingly. And the same alien that was involved, the same alien that was involved with the Travis Walton case, and he's loosely known as the captain, El Supremo being on the administrative side with his staff along that grade, and the captain being out in the field with his staff in that peculiar ship, his diamond-shaped ship, and it really is a diamond-shaped-looking ship, are very upset about all this because they got it wrong. And that reflects on them. So they could lose their privileges, and they could lose their positions because they made such an error. And I did put a good word for them. I says, we did not know, or we did not assume when we made these TV transmissions that they would be received by any alien civilization at all, because no one even conceived of alien civilizations until the late 60s, or at least it wasn't openly discussed a great deal, or assumed that passerbys, and that's what their even bigger concern is. So if an alien's passing by, gets these transmissions. Well, how could he get these transmissions? The aliens have a very unique, but very efficient system of communication here in this galaxy and the three other galaxies involved. Now, rather than have everyone send out signals like we do on shortwave frequency modulation or amplitude modulation, they have a system of newsstands. Now, the gargantuan boxes out there.
We'll be right back in just a few minutes, and we'll explain the alien communication technology. You can check out Bernie's website, bernardmendez.com, and also ufoqanda.com. We'll be back at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Jump on your Skype and your chat rooms and your Facebook and all of that kind of stuff, and ask people, please, you know, come and listen to this particular episode with Bernard Mendez from BernardMendez.com and UFOQ&A.com. We were talking over the break about the reason why Bernie wasn't able to come on last time. It was because of, well, basically the storm and everything around him was just completely and utterly destroyed. But we'll leave that for a moment. And I wanted you to, you said you were talking about alien communication devices or some kind of box, and then that's, we want to somehow weave that into kind of your past and experience in these particular fields and what your job descriptions were. But please continue.
I've actually observed this box. Now, I was a trained observer when I was a young child. I had pointed out things from time to time, which was noticed by my father, who was in the army, and he was a very suspicious general. He was quite old when he had me, and I was always pointing at things. And one day they were having a barbecue with their close friends, and I began pointing at the sky, and one of his closest friends, Douglas MacArthur, the general of the army, was there and said, what's the matter with the boy, you know? I says, well, he's been acting strangely. He's always going around staring at things, and he's pointing at things. I said, well, what's he staring at now, you know? And I was actually staring at a UFO. that was about a mile and a half to 2 miles from where they were, looking out a big window, and I started pointing at it. I've been since questioned about this incident over the years. I was 2 years, 6 months, 3 days old, according to the official naval report, when this happened. And I continued to point, and, you know, these are the type of people you don't screw around with when you play jokes with. And my father sent out a P-51 Mustang from a base not far away. Now, this could have happened right not far from where I live. I assume it did. The scene looks familiar. I look around there from time to time. And I kept pointing, and my father was a very stern man, and he actually made me continue to point. And eventually, he was communicating over the phone to the control tower, giving instructions to a pilot, whose name I think was Jack Brady. And he told him to do loop-de-loops and figure eights. And now, this was a clear blue sky. You could see for at least, whatever, visibility 10 miles, they used to say, which is very good visibility. And there's not a cloud in the sky. And he began doing loop-de-loops at about, I think, 800 to 1,100 feet. A mile and a half from my position. I can give more details. There's a big report about all this someplace. And bam, you know, everyone heard the noise. The pilot bailed out. And you see the parachute. I remember clearly seeing P-51 hit something and then the pilot bailing out. And that's when everyone really got concerned. Told him to go pick up the pilot. They all began talking about this. And they all decided to bug out. And that's what ultimately started me down this road. And later on, when everyone had gone apparently to some sort of bunker area, I'm not going to give details about that at all, we began, these individuals, and I'm sure you can assume who they were now, that I mentioned someone's name, began doing flashcards with me. So they sat me up and showed me flashcards and were coaxing me into pointing at whatever it is I saw, because nobody else saw it. But that P-51 did hit something. There were lots of witnesses between the tower, people on the field, the people at the party were all... brass taxes, they say, and a lot of chiefs there too, and disrespect any enlisted personnel. But there were a lot of witnesses. And I eventually pointed out a diamond shaped, gold color UFO. I'm sure UFOpictures.com is something very similar there. And that's how I got started. And eventually, they determined that I have a very peculiar eye arrangement. And going through all this rigmarole with rods and cones and all this other peculiar things. Of course, there is another theory, which a certain Dr. Eskenazi, that wasn't his name at the time, came up with. He said, perhaps it's not that I have acute vision. Maybe I have normal vision. And maybe or everybody else has substandard vision, what we call normal vision. That's a possibility too. So depending how you want to look at it, but I've been poked and prodded ever since. I'd probably be autopsied beyond belief when I pass on. At least I've been threatened with autopsy from time to time by, I think, Dr. Sear, David Sear, and a few other people. But that's how I got started. And from time to time, I would go for training. Win the jump rooms, or my cousin George, who I really like. He's a big guy, about 6'2", 6'4", would escort me to the different areas. Now, this is back in the 1960s.
If I may, children have a particular sensitivity to things that adults can't see a lot of the times. And I've heard that basically if your children see or do something that you don't quite understand, or they think that they're seeing something that you don't think is there at all, if you write it down and look back on it later, you'll find out what it means, sort of thing. And my contention is that we're all born with this kind of potential, but very, very early on in life, it sort of wanes because it's not reinforced or helped along in any way, shape, or form. So it just kind of, that ability just sort of disappears. You reckon that might have something to do with why you, at a very young age, were discovered and actually, shall we say, helped along in this particular type of vision that you had?
Nurtured. Yes, it's called being nurtured. And that is a theory. And it's a very common theory. It was a prevailing theory for many years. But, you know, even though people are nurtured, some people don't take to it. You know, it's like some people are nurtured to swim, but they don't take to swimming. They don't like swimming. Some people are nurtured to play piano, but they don't play the piano. They just don't take to it. Like my niece, she plays the piano quite well. She really took to it. Like, you know, I coaxed her along as much as I could. That is a theory. It's a prevailing theory. It does work most of the time. But I, you know, as I went on for further training, you know, things like the high altitude test. Now, you could be nurtured all you want in a high altitude test where they bring you to a room, put you on oxygen, bring you to an altitude of, say, above 10,000 feet where the oxygen content is low, or 15,000, 20,000, or 40,000, whatever. Then they take the oxygen mask off, and then you got to play cards, write something, or sing a song, and they see how you react to all of this. Now, you could do it all you want, but some people are going to panic, and some people are not going to panic. So I didn't panic, and that was part of this training. Now, I did it three times. I think once and always about 8 years old, another time, twice when I was about... Once when I think about 15, and then another time when I was about 18 or 19 years old, something like that, when I took the flight physical. So a lot of people can be trained, can take a flight physical and fail, whatever reasons they have. So, and I passed the flight physical, and then there was the other medical board with the Navy, because I've trained as a Navy diver, and then I passed that medical board. That was a full medical board. So I went through at least two full medical boards by the time I was 21. My career was basically over at 22. As far as jumping goes, because, you know, Andrew was going into that about what are the effects of jumping. There's a lot of side effects because you have to be put on oxygen when you come back. And some people don't take well to being put on oxygen. I mean, no matter how you train. Some people can breathe oxygen for 10 minutes. Others can breathe it for like an hour. And then all sorts of complications set in. So, beyond that, Nixon knew of me. Nixon knew of this incident. I know that from talking to him personally. I had dinner with him three times, twice at the White House and once when he moved to New York. I should have had more dinner when he had in California, but I didn't have plane fare to fly all the way out to California. Although I think his name Judith was trying to get me to go see him in California. It was fairly close to him for a period of time. Very nice fellow. He's very good to me. Give me just about everything I wanted. And I would go for this training, and he would send me to the areas. And he would have questions for me, usually 17 questions. But after a while, they were repetitive. Then I would go talk to the space aliens about, or go to the different area commanders and ask them questions, because the appropriation bill was coming on. And then I would ask favors like, you know, can I go to Vietnam temporarily? You know, be John Wayne for a day. So it's very dangerous going there. You know, get hurt. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I did everything I wanted to do. And things were very good for me that way. And, you know, I got no complaints in that respect. But that's how I did it. I just continued to do things. And I didn't know there was a fellow. See, Nixon, when he came into the office, he really didn't appoint a lot of the individuals in his administration. He actually had a package deal where he agreed, you know, if he was, they swore him for president, like the ministers in England. He had a package deal. Then he appointed all these people to different positions. But there was a guy by the name of Rumsfeld who was good friends with Agnew, Dr. Agnew, and the College of Siskiyous, who found people like me who could do these, what they called amazing things. And then they would nurture them, coax them along. They always convinced me to do these things. And then, you know, give you more and more training and give you more and more things to do. Now, had I known that, which I didn't really at the time, because Rumsfeld was that peculiar fellow, and I bought quite a few of his speeches when I was quite young. And nobody ever told me this. If somebody told me this, what I knew now, back then, I would have never done some of these things. If you did something for him and you did it well, he gave you something else to do. And if you did that well, he'll give you a couple of things to do. If you did that well, he'll give you three or four other things to do. So the more the things you did for him, the more he gave you to do. And he did that way with everybody. Until eventually people like, you know, didn't go near him or something. Or change their name. I don't know. And that's how I came along in this project. Would you like me to finish about this elaborate communication system that the space aliens have?
We've got about two to three minutes to wrap it up before the break. Yeah, sure.
Mm. Well, the reason why I'd say that is because a lot of my training and Petty Officer Keel, Chief Keel, our family's very close at one time, always was of the opinion, and he put his opinion on record, that I had probably seen things that I never reported that were of great interest to the government, not to mention the whole spy network that was trailing me around on my coattails from time to time. I never knew it. I mean, I probably seen things and never knew what they were. So he had this theory that I should be brought along a little bit more. And so I began developing like a photographic memory from time to time. And had I known the pitfalls of photographic memory, I never would have went down that road. But that's another story altogether. So I actually had seen pictures of this peculiar communication center that the space aliens have, amongst other things. They show me an awful many details of alien-related things. I brought aboard many ships just to look around. I didn't touch anything. I really didn't stay long. Sometimes I stayed, you know, a minute or two, walked around, looked at these devices. Is that? It was just, you know, and then left. Then I give them my opinion about what I saw. And one of the biggest questions I had, because I made a list of questions that I had, which I eventually addressed to the space aliens per sidebar, because I requested that after I get through with the negotiations that you wanted me to do based on your questions, what they call talking points, whatever, or parameters that you have to negotiate with, may I ask them these other questions? And I would submit it. I say, oh, go ahead. This, you know, common things. And some of the questions I asked them is like, how do they navigate through space? And how do you communicate? And this question, these two questions, to this day, I get asked questions by retired Navy personnel mainly, who says, did you ever ascertain how they do this?
Well, we'll talk about this after the break. It seems like as soon as we get into something, we get cut off by a break because you take a long time to kind of discuss things because you elaborate a lot of detail and background. And it occurs to me, Bernie, that your memory is really, really, really sharp, sharper than most people's at your age for sure. We'll be right back after the break with Bernard Mendez, ladies and gentlemen.
There's something evolving. whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guest is Bernie Mendez from UFOQA.com and also BernardMendez.com. Now, you were talking about those two questions that you get asked and also that you asked yourself. How do aliens communicate across long distances in space, and also how do they navigate their craft? If you could elaborate on that, that'd be awesome.
Yes. They've worked out a very unique and very practical system. What they said was through mutual respect and consideration, they've worked out this system. Now, this is in the three known galaxies that are involved in all that we're involved in, plus the other three galaxies that are more like isolationists. But the system predominates. Rather than have millions of civilizations sending out transmissions like we have shortwave, amplitude modulation, frequency modulation, then you go into Packard and all these other microwave transmissions and all gamma, whatever. So rather than have everybody transmitting in every different direction, they came up with a very simple system. They have this gargantuan box out there, and I've seen it myself because they actually showed it to me. And what they do is you pull up to this box. Now think of it like a newsstand where you upload and download things. So you send all your personal messages down there. It's encrypted, some of them. You get all the latest news, you know, hello, Krell, your wife gave birth to a baby boy, or, you know, you got a wedding to go to, or your son is graduating college, or got a doctor's appointment, whatever. A lot of them are personal, that, like that sort of thing. Or that the ship has instructions, ship number 2612 times 10 to the 15th power. You know, you have a survey to make in this part of the galaxy, and need requested to bring your services to that part of the galaxy. You can actually pick up items. They actually have a storage area to pick up certain types of items. And they're in a lot of parts of the galaxy. Between the galaxies, that's what I was told. I actually seen one or two. The federal government got very interested in this when they actually got some real-time intelligence in the recent past. I brought this to their attention 36 or 38 years ago, believe it or not. I said exactly what I'm saying to you, to them. There's a report someplace about it. So that's how they communicate. They don't like to transmit. Because of the fact, like I said, it interferes with other devices they have, like beacons or proximity warning beacons. So, like we have these lights on, safety lights on buildings at night. When you walk by it, you trip the sensor, and the light comes on. They have those type of things. When you get near something, it gives you a warning. So, proximity warning. You're entering this space. And then they have these other buoys, and I have a picture of one here someplace of this elaborate buoy system they have. It gives you a lot of warnings about things. It's on a postcard of symbols. There's one not far from here. It's been seen from time to time by different astronomers and observers. It's a big sort of like cube or diamond shape. It's flashing different colors, either yellow dots on red or black dots on yellow, and it's sending out peculiar signals. And what it is, it's like a warning buoy. It's saying not to approach this sector of space unless you have a permit, because according to the captain, who's the Walton alien, and his two assistants, who he has, his captain's an old cantankerous captain who's been around this galactic 5, and he's very quite specific, 6, 7, 8 times. I mean, he's been certain places 5 times, other places 6 times, other places 7 times, and other places 8 times, and that's exactly the way they put it to me. Why he's quite proud of it. He's a captain turned doctor, and he explained that that buoy is like a quarantine buoy. It's in all the known languages, all the known symbolology and colors, because some races are near death or colorblind. So how are you going to communicate? You communicate through different symbols, telling, and then they should know what to do from there. Otherwise, they're going to, what it's saying, you're liable to be boarded if you go into these certain areas in our space. Or if you do come to this area in space, you're allowed to fly by, because everyone's reporting a lot of peculiar flying things around the planet these days. I think that's what it's all about. And that's how they communicate. Now, how they navigate is very similar. Now, this is going to sound quite incredulous, but I haven't been so incredulous already. The planet Saturn and its rings are tilted at a certain angle. And on the north pole of the planet Saturn is a very large obelisk. And as you approach the planet Saturn, it sends out a message. And you should know how to ping it, like a submarine pings to get a target. Then the ship would ping that target. And then it would send back saying, oh, your ship number 2612 times 10 to the 23rd power, you're in this sector of space. These are our rules. This is where the newsstand is. And then you should know how to navigate, because you should know, like the road signs that we have, a very unique road sign. Like, for instance, if we had a road sign out in space that had the Statue of Liberty where Saturn is, right? Everyone would know that, correct? And say, well, if you see the arm with the light of the Statue of Liberty, make a left towards the planet Earth. Well, that's simple enough to remember. And that's their elaborate, part of their elaborate system. The other part, where there's vast darkness, vast areas of darkness, is they have a checkerboard, little square boxes, and a big board with all with little square boxes. And I don't know how they're doing this. They must have buoys squawking someplace. They actually have this checkerboard, and it's all white boxes. And sometimes a box would go black. And by reading the black boxes in the direction forward, aft, port, and starboard, you get a position report as to where you are. And these black boxes, little squares, cubes, of this big grid, and you should know by experience, tells you what obstructions are ahead and what obstructions are behind and what's to the port and starboard of you. And you know by, sometimes a box is half at an angle, white and black. And then you get a sense by, now you have to go through an elaborate training course and an elaborate simulator for this. But basically you start to get an understanding of how they navigate through the vastness of space. Which led to other questions, like, we consider space on rocketry, and the equations still hold, that it will take X amount of time to go from point A to point B in a rocket. Well, they've obviously figured a way around that. So whatever they're doing, I asked them about, and they eventually talked. They said something to the effect that they have over 70 types of secrets to travel to space, and they're not going to share them all with us. They will, however, share at least 3 or 4 secrets, some of which we've got, some of which we're elaborating on or back engineering on, and some of which, well, I don't know where to go with that. But those are some of the questions they asked them. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the other element here is that I had Douglas Dietrich on the show, and he's a Department of Defense librarian until, I think, 1992. And he said something along the lines of, I have other people to do my writing for me, because when I write stuff down, it's just basically people say it's like a field manual, you know, it's very impersonal.
Reports. Yes.
Well, exactly. And you speak like he writes. You know, it's just an analytical kind of report, details, you know, this kind of thing. That's part of your experience and what you were required to do during your employment for the U.S. government, wasn't it?
Yes. You're a little broken, but I got that. I tried to... I went to a writing course, quite a few writing courses, and try. I know what you're saying. It's very difficult. See, the government speaks its own language, and the administration I worked for had summarizations of reports, not details sometimes. And that people in the Nixon administration, especially Dick, that's what I call him, had so much experience from the prior administrations that he knew everything, and he would just read summarizations. He didn't really care for too many details. Go ahead.
Well, I've always found that you let the kind of the eyewitness testimony and whatever evidence you come across kind of help to expand on areas that are of interest to you. And often, if you don't know exactly what somebody's talking about, or if they're kind of losing you or whatever, it simply means that you haven't seen enough information to you know, bring that conclusion forward in your own mind. So if people are listening now to Bernie and they don't quite get it or whatever, trust me, this is another vein of your research that you can dig into, and you can go dig into it at bernardmendez.com and ufoqna.com. And we'll be right back at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's hour number two, the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, almost as fast as time travel and teleportation. My very special guest is Bernard Mendez from bernardmendez.com and ufoqna.com. Now, getting on to the topic of aliens, there's a lot of interesting things out there, and I mentioned Douglas Dietrich before, and he in fact was involved with Michael Aquino, who was the official registered army satanic chaplain kind of thing, and he talked about this one time where he said that if you what was he saying? He saw a bunch of dead Vietnamese people, and he called them aliens, like illegal aliens and what have you. And then DOD told him to start propagating this this alien myth or what have you, so that each person that started to believe in aliens was one more soul that they could consign to hell, kind of thing. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that or things of that nature, but yeah, I thought that was very interesting because there's we're broken up just a little bit here. Apparently, Bernie can't hear me too well. Is it better now when I talk slower? Yeah, okay. If you would just tell us what you know about aliens in general and what the agenda is with the U.S. government.
The agendas, and we're talking about aliens in general, correct?
Yes.
Okay. When I was negotiating, we didn't there's some words in the jump rooms that we didn't really, or etymology, we didn't really have. One of them was hologram, and one of them was agendas that applied to this whole ET question. But eventually it would. Now, the alien agendas, as they became to be known as over the course of time, I'm pushing 60 years old, we're talking a very, very long time ago, was sort of like a lot of things that needed that were denied. Sometimes they were very complicated things, and sometimes they were very simple things. I believe that the approach to this whole ET question with the generation behind me was wrong, that my generation, me, got it right, and the next generation, hopefully, will get it all right. I think that sometimes people overestimate things, and sometimes people underestimate things. And I think they looked at this whole ET questions and never saw it for simply what it is. Now, I had contact with a lot of ETs, and I certainly asked the questions aforementioned with many shows and interviews I did. And I eventually got responses. But the responses, and I think Rumsfeld, with all his shortcomings, probably said it best. People went into this arena with under an impression and were expecting something, and that didn't happen. Therefore, they began dismissing things. And that's where this whole problem lies. For instance, now, and a cigar-shaped UFO with the little fellows who I met quite a few times, they know me by name, they came here, and they've now been observed over the decades. What I was saying 36 years ago was that they were actually cultivating some flora, trees, flowers, and flora is what we usually used to say. We try and summarize the reports. So we didn't say oak trees, birch trees, maple trees. We say trees. And we don't say petunias or orchards. We say flowers. And the flora would be like bushes. You know, so it would be trees, flower, and flora. They were doing things like that. And nobody believed it. They felt they were here for other reasons. All the more sinister plots were developing. Now, there have been attempts to say that they pose a threat. Now, the threat issue is what they call an assessment. There's a very long document. I've read it 2 or 3 times before I began to comprehend it, called the assessment, which is updated every so many years, no matter what. And this assessment contains the entire ET question and how it pertains to all of us across the board, economically, religious implications, and down the road, and tries to look down the road 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Now, I don't see how these beings coming here and doing this particular items pose a threat. But I was always been persuaded that they pose a threat. Now, of all the things I've done, and I was involved in finding the pyramid in Alaska, looking for one down in Aussie land, the pyramid, and was Plan Zero, the pyramids that I helped find that Navy SEAL team that I used out by, where is that Plan Zero book? I forget where, out by Romania someplace, and so many other things based on this world grid, that all these things are some sort of coincidence, and that as advanced as they are, and now we have the things down in NASDAQ lines and the things that were said in the area of the NASDAQ lines. And one of my theories posed to the individuals looking at all that in the ancient alien theories was that the Nasdaq lounge had giant pictures of monkeys and giant pictures of hummingbirds and giant pictures of leopards and giant pictures of space aliens. I proposed that that meant something. So like monkeys meant we mined the coal that was in the area, the minerals and resources and metals that were in the area, and we know it was mined. And the monkeys meant come to this area and we'll where the coal is stashed. Or the hummingbird meant come to this area and where we have all the metals piled up that we're mining. Or come to this other area where there's another symbol where we have all the beryllium. Now, this was done a very long time ago. I know geologists. I'm an amateur geologist myself. And everyone's not openly discussing it like we are, but something was mined down there a very, very long time ago. So whatever they wanted, they took a very long time ago. So where's the threat? Now, there's a lot of money to be made in a threat assessment with different agendas. And that's one of the agendas. For instance, like you take an area like El Dulce that was found on the ground. There were numerous wars with them, and there's more than Indian legends about it. And there was numerous conflicts, but they have never been completely explained. Now, I was involved in one of them in October, June, July, 1980. Over at Holloman Air Force Base. Now, why did this conflict happen? I still get asked questions to this day. No one knows. Apparently, someone found another entrance to the Dulce area, not far from Holloman. And I knew Snyder. I was there with him. He asked me to come with him because he went through. Now, I don't know how this is going to sound. I'm not an egotistical man. I had a chain of command. Besides Lieutenant Colonel Hughes, the deputy base commander, Colonel Brown, the base commander, and Chief Gentile, the chief of the base, I had another chain of command. But Lieutenant Colonel Hughes had the clearance for the areas, and he knew that I had the clearance, and a handful of people knew about me. So when Snyder came to me at the time, he asked me, because he was a demolitionist, he was thinking UDT, I think. He asked me to come with him, and he wanted me to survey an area with him to find this entrance. He was pretty sure it was around there, and I did find it eventually, and I showed him. Him being a demolition expert, he knew how which way I wanted to focus the explosions on, and eventually he found some sort of peculiar tunnel way the hell down there. And that's what led up to this Dulce wall at the time. So now,
what is the Dulce Wars?
Apparently many years ago in the Dulce area, there was a very big battle between Indians, some locals, and some space aliens. They found the dead bodies. They found the expended cartridges. This was a subject that was in the newspaper locally, and a story of Indian legends or legends of that area, what they call the Mesa area. I'm quite familiar with that area. I used to go camping around there sometimes. So there was apparently there was some skirmishes or people disappearing in this area, and apparently scouting parties went out, and apparently there was conflict going on, and apparently the locals got really ticked off, heavily armed themselves, because they all had about 250 rounds each, and went into this area and started shooting at anything that moved. Apparently they lost, although I hear that two or three individuals escaped taking off on horseback and riding due southeast, because the next at that time the only place we would be water would be besides Albuquerque would be probably be down by Alamogordo Way or Tula Rosa or down in Oro Grande, and then they were chased, and that was the first recorded. Now, there may have been other skirmishes of this, they call Dulce Wars. Now, I've heard this spoken to now by at least three credible sources, one being, and I knew the Mescalero Apaches. I don't know Mexicaria Apaches, but even the Mescalero Apaches down there, plus a supervisor down there, he's long dead. And now a third party, I'm not going to name, it's not dead yet. So that was one of these skirmishes that was going on in this very peculiar area. Now, at some point after this incident, the government began mining. Somebody began mining in this area. And then the World War II came along, and the government confiscated this area to build the bases and other matters. And then they began tunneling down. And they did find the area, because I'd been there. I didn't know where I was at the time. But from every description that I heard so far, in that peculiar elevator, everyone said the same thing. I'd never forget it. I give you details about that. But I'm not going to go into that this time. It was known as Dulce. I don't know what is Dulce. As a matter of fact, the only reason why I pursued this is because someone gave a lecture. It wasn't just Joanne Richards at echochicks.com, the email address. Someone else had given a lecture, either on Coast to Coast or some other lecture I went to, which was describing the same place that I was at with Snyder. And before that, with the Navy. And but they called it El Dulce, and I actually had contacted someone. I said, you know, this place over there, it's called Dulce. I know it's another name. I'm not going to say the name because apparently someone's questioning my credibility. I can challenge them right now, whoever it is. I'm in the phone book. You can't miss me. And I could go point for point with many details about this area. So, and I didn't know it at the time, but apparently the government, when I was on active duty, found another way in and was planning a major offensive to enter this very large underground facility, which was space aliens in it. Now, it's on YouTube, Dulce Wars, ULSEDULCE, two words. And that's what it looked like. Because I actually made a film very similar to that. It's about 10 miles and has a lot of peculiar things. I didn't see anybody being raped, or I don't know of any genetic experiments. These big tubes where they claim what is some kind of carcasses in them, or what's going on in genetics, have been there. And I asked a close friend of mine to tell me what's going on down there. Those genetic red tubular things have been are the same way as when I saw them 36 or 38 years ago. They haven't changed. Although occasionally some space aliens go around there and with their instruments and take readings, no one's has touched them. They haven't moved. So I don't know what they're talking about. There is a peculiar tram or a tube with like an elevator in it. Like an escalator. It's like the elevators in the airports where you're walking down to the different gates and you have that elevator that you stand on, and it's a flat elevator, and it moves you along horizontally along the floor. It's very similar to that, and it has a glass tube around it, like a bubble.
Well, you're talking about Phil Schneider, wasn't he? Who's the guy who lost a couple of fingers? Alien kind of like shoot this bolt of energy or something out of its hand and like blew off a chunk of him, killed all the people at random, and he was...
When he entered...
Yeah. Oh, hold on, we're coming into break, Mooney. We'll be right back.
We'll break.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. 5 days a week, ladies and gentlemen, you can tune in. Also, after the broadcast each day, normally we will be having a Skype chat with the listeners. So if you join us in the chat room at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, we can give you the my Skype details and you just ring me direct and I add you in. And it's kind of like a little round table with the listeners, and sometimes the guests from the show hold over. For example, yesterday, Andrew Bashago had nearly about an hour and a half, nearly 2 hour conversation with us after the broadcast. So if you want to be able to get in touch with me or anybody else really, or feel quite so alone as a truther. I think that's the real problem with knowing what the heck is going on, is that you feel like you're the only one. And when you're hanging out with people who do know what's going on also, suddenly that feeling of loneliness disappears. And hopefully that'll be the way we continue forward in the future. My special guest is Bernard Mendez from bernardmendez.com. and UFOQ&A.com. We were talking over the break about Phil Schneider. Those of you who do not know who he is, has a few fingers missing on one of his hands that he says were blown off during an underground incursion during the construction of, I think, a deep underground military base around the Dulce area at the time. And Bernie was explaining to me some things over the break, but I'm not sure if he's allowed to elaborate on those topics. But Bernie, what would you say on this situation and about Phil Schneider?
Phil Schneider was a good man. Apparently, he retired and went out and lived west someplace. And I don't know who his friends were. He has a great deal of information at his home, which somebody should take care of. Perhaps make a museum or make copies to the Center for UFO Studies where everyone can review it. Perhaps get a grant and put it on a website. It would explain a great many things, perhaps down the road. He was with the ONI a long time. He died before his time. I think he had radiation poisoning besides his disability on his arm. I'm not sure. I know he was having problems in the area where he lived with intruders who were snooping on him. And then he had complained about this snooping that was going on, people trespassing on his land. Some say they were kids just hanging out getting drunk. But, you know, if you look at this place, it's in the middle of nowhere. Why would they, you know, come up at his house? I also heard that there were people trying to enter either without a forced entry in his actual home, and that he had set a trap and the trap had sprung, and that several people got really ticked off at this because he figured out that somebody was trying to get in. And apparently no one complained about this person who got caught in a trap that Phil Schneider set to capture the intruder to this day. So apparently he was some sort of, I don't want to say this over the radio. We have words here locally that we call people like that, whom you catch in the act of a crime and become deceased, or you set a trap for, get caught and nobody shows up to claim the body, sort of thing. I'm not going to say what it's called. But,
sort of like how a drug dealer may get robbed, but he doesn't go to the police or report that he was robbed because he was doing something illegal. Similar principle, isn't it?
I believe the person that was doing this didn't realize who Phil Snyder was, and we used to call him Zips when I was a kid. He was somebody that was, you know, quite expendable, I guess. I'm sure eventually whoever sent him knows that, you know, he got caught. Now, I'd be interested to know who sent them. But I did write my congressman about this. And this is when I began growing very concerned. Someone very notable called me about his death. And he died before his time. And I really didn't want to step forward. I feel that stepping forward may lead to more incidences of this type. Although there's a great deal of people that seem to feel that stepping forward may prevent more of these instances, like Phil Snyder. He's not the only one. But there's a lot of people that got involved with these programs that have met an early demise. Go ahead.
I've got a pin on my shoulder, like, you, how can I put this? I've met a lot of people doing this job who are, say, perhaps regular marijuana users, but they never say during the interviews in general that they are, because they fear repercussion from that vein, that everybody will call them a drug head or something of that nature. As a direct result of that fear of persecution, cannabis is still illegal. If everybody who used it regularly came out openly saying that, yes, I do, it wouldn't be illegal for long. It would, in fact, encourage others to come out and talk about it. And I see this as a similar principle with many fields of research. If you come out and reveal certain things, it encourages other people to come out and say similar things, like breaking the ice.
That's true. Phil Snyder was very brave for stepping forward. I don't know what led him up stepping forward. When I seen him on YouTube, he did look familiar, and what he was talking about, it sounded familiar, especially when he got to the part where he was doing underground demolition, trying to find an entrance to the Dulce area. But it was far away from where the original Dulce area was. But I knew the range quite well, the White Sands Missile Test Range. It's officially called the U.S. Army Proving Grounds, White Sands Missile Test Range, Alamogordo, New Mexico, 88330. And that's what his assignment was. I mean, and he was asking me to help him, which I did. And he was a very nice fellow. And stepping forward has positive things and has negative things. You know, when I got involved in the CT question, I was quite young, quite fit, quite tight-assed. And I really, you know, got my jollies off of it. And I really loved doing the work. And being on the cutting edge like this, I thought this was like the most fantastic thing in the world to do. Then one day I ran into a group of people who injected religion into this equation. and said, this is all evil. That's could be some sort of, you know, antichrist thing, a devilish thing. And if you're involved in this, well, maybe you're evil too, you know. And my usual response was, and it had to happen a few times, because Nixon did his response as well. If you say this guy, this young guy is evil, who the rest of them down the hall? I mean, just watch him down the hall, were they some kind of relative? So, to make a little pun about it. So, there's always a good thing and a bad thing, which leads me to the Manhattan Project, which I got involved in a little bit, because I transferred over there. And an individual I met who kind of explained it, and that's why I think like this to this day. He left a very vivid impression about me, about a great many things. But one of the most things that impressed me most was what he said to the following. That he had been involved with the Manhattan Project here at Columbia University just about from the very beginning. He was worked as a professor's assistant and worked his way up. He had actually helped build the first compiler of the atomic pile, which was made of these, and he actually showed me one. He still had a few left. They're big carbon blocks, about 4 inches square and about 2 or 3 feet long, all the way around, rectangular blocks. And they built a rectangular block on rectangular block. That's pretty, they got was carbon, retained the radiation quite well. And then they put the rods closer together, and it made a lot of heat, made a lot of sparking too, but there are films of this because the radiation wasn't refined. And he remembers quite vividly sitting there when they got this damn thing to work, and that came out with radiation poisoning, of course, and figured out a cure back and whatnot. He remembered sitting there with his professors. Eventually he rose some level of prominence. I'm not going to mention his name. But he said that he envisioned the future from this, and he figured out that he could make cheaper electricity because it didn't cost anything for the atomic pile to run. Once you got it working, pull the rods in, you can run water through it and make steam. When you make steam, you could turn the turbine. And when you turn the turbine, you could turn the generator and make very cheap electricity. And he thought this was the most fantastic thing he had ever done. He was so proud to be with this project. It gave him a great sense of joy to go to work a day, even though he got acute radiation poisoning eventually had become disabled. But then years later, he found out something, that somebody actually had made a bomb and actually made a bomb from it, and actually we could blow the world up for it and then put the bomb on top of a missile or in a bomber plane, a bomber jet, and was actually, you know, do mass casualty incidences with it. And he never was, he was like a broken man for a while. But the moral of the story being that, you know, out of this great discovery came a really good thing. And also somebody used it for another purpose, which they didn't think was a really good thing. And I think that's what happened with Snyder and the people he was involved with. Some people thought that this was a really good thing. A lot of people thought, well, this is not a really good thing, and began aggravating him for some reason or spying on him for some reason. I've had the same problem, come to think about it. So if a lot of people get involved with the project, that people that you couldn't prove existed would start in with you and ask you for information. I complained about a great many people in my day. Right, well, there's no right or wrong about it. They felt they had the right to do what they did.
So you were dealing with amoral agents, really?
You're a little broken.
Well, amoral agents. People without conscience. that's what we're dealing with ultimately. And part of my research has led me to believe that there really is nothing they won't do. Morals are restraint. These guys have no restraints. So keep talking, Ben.
Yeah. The ends justify the means. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Some people feel that this technology that is there right now, well, that they should have the technology. Will there be groups within our own governments, or groups from foreign governments, or even groups that are unknown? There's three, four groups that are still unknown. They feel they have the moral right, absolutely, to become involved and confiscate this technology.
Well, it seems that when we're talking about control mechanisms, ladies and gentlemen, these are the ones that are the most important. The keeping of advanced technologies from the rest of us leads to a technocracy. Those with the technology will be in control of those who don't have it. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the most technically plagued 2 hours in talk radio. Bernie, you wanted to wrap up with some of the elements of Andy's story.
Yes.
We only have about 10 minutes. Go for your life.
Okay. Agnew was a very great man, and he really brought a lot of people together that he saw that could do these type of missions. And you know, I wouldn't have done a lot of these missions if he hadn't encouraged me. I remember him quite well. I knew his name was Agnew, which I later found out there was a vice president by that name. I don't know if they were related, but I did ask him one time, there was a vice president by your name. Global warming was discussed, although it wasn't really a big deal. My theory was that if you take the cubic feet of water existing on this planet and take the amount of ice on this planet and melt that ice, by now we should have basically 2 to 4 feet of water in Manhattan. So I know they gave a bunch of Nobel Prizes out for all this. I did quite a bit of amount of work myself and never got recognized. But my whole basic theory is, where is the water going? It's got to be going someplace. So that's an issue. I think even some court people recognize that too. This whole psychotronic thing is quite new to me. I know it was low-level electronic warfare. This whole teleportation issue as to what we're going to do with it ultimately is an issue. The mandate from Congress to find practical uses for teleportation. I think sending mail and packages like we do UPS or FedEx, surely that could be used for that. I don't see why. I was even commenting about that 36 years ago, why couldn't he use? Somebody said that it cost too much money to do, but that is yet to be proved or disproved. I was told that Tulsa Technology was involved in this. I've seen a lot of Tulsa's devices. And let me assure one and all, and all the listeners out there who know me, these devices have never been duplicated. I could not determine what kind of metal they were. They were very peculiar looking, but they offered a lot of promise as far as what they could do. In fact, I'm speaking with Tom right now about some of them. One device actually lit up a great area quite brilliantly with very soft light. And I discovered that it was all protons inside. So we generate power with power generation and power transmission, which they know quite well. The generation side is electrons and protons, but apparently the aliens have separated these two, protons being for lighting, and the electrons being the more dynamic force for is to move machinery. And they can generate somehow and separate the two, which is what we're ultimately going to do. I think ultimately this technology is going to be used. When and where, I don't know. Who's actually going to take the lead and begin using it is another story. Whether or not Tulsa actually built some of these devices, I don't know. I'm beginning to get the impression that these devices were alien devices. Now, Andrew has a very specific concept of time and this time travel. I'm not disagreeing that that doesn't exist from time to time or in minutes or in hours ahead back and forth, maybe as much as 3 days. But my theory, and it was a two prevailing theory that I knew, was I had a great professor. It was Dr. Ehrlichson, Dr. Robbins, and then Rico Fermi's team, and some of the professors down there, as well as some of the other professors I know. And they explain time very simply to me. Time is made of linear time and nonlinear time. Linear time being quite simple. You take time, go to point A, go to point B, point C, point D. And if you go back to point A and kill your parents, then you would not exist at point D. Or you would affect some outcome in point D. Nonlinear time is the same thing, but when you go back to point A and say you kill your parents, there is no effect in point B. Apparently, something along that line is happening. Now, my view was that because when I went to these areas in the past, as well as the future, but I'll get to that. The whole future thing is a different story than the past. When I went to these past events, they didn't look around as thoroughly as I did. I looked around quite thoroughly, brought back samples, and I found something out. They weren't identical samples. This was some kind of artificial world. And the past events that we went to, and some of them quite elaborate, were not real. They appeared to be some sort of, now the word didn't exist at the time, hologram, or part mannequins, or part real beings. But there was one event, and Brett Stillings was involved in this one. So was I. Now, Brett went on a jump with a female. I don't recall her name. He's listed there. And apparently there was this kid that was involved, and it slid off. We had made a ramp. Andrew's father had helped the ramp. He went up there, and then he passed away after that. Sorry to see. To make sure the ramp was done properly so it wouldn't collapse, a dirt ramp, because these creatures could not go uphill for some reason, which I filed a report about that too. And so when he made this ramp, apparently Brett and this female went up to this ramp, and they were checking it out, making sure what was going on. They had this corrugated tin on the side of the ramp they were going to strategically place. So if the ramp collapsed or started to collapse, the tin on the side would move, and then you would know it was partially collapsing. And apparently this young boy came out and got mauled by this creature and then died. nobody was ever recovering. But when they came back, I was there because I was very busy that day. So they asked me to go back to this area and find out what happened and see if they could find this kid and bring him back, which is what I did. I didn't see any kid there where the area that he told me was quite accurate because there's one piece that's in there going down the side and nothing, no kid was there. But then when, on our way back, this kid mysteriously appears. He runs up this ramp again, slides down the side, and this event happens all over again. So I said, let's go back, and then we'll come back with another team and find out what happened. Now, another team came back, and I'm not going to go into details because there's people questioning my integrity and whatnot, but this event happened for the third time. And an elaborate report was filed about this, and everyone was questioned very thoroughly because now we took a casualty, and everyone was accounted for. Now, what happened? Apparently some sort of term, which is the first time I heard it, I give you my word, called some kind of causality loop. We're in some kind of loop, and we don't know the cause. Something was causing this loop. Now, as to what was going on, I don't know. After that, I went home. I've never discussed that again until many years later. But apparently, we were repeating this with different people. And that was my theory on this whole time travel business. You're going back to the same area. Something's repeating. You have different personnel, and there's an interaction of a similar or an alike event for some reason. Now, why somebody had created this world, most of it artificial, I don't know. There's got to be a point to it. There's got to be a purpose. Is it some kind of training? Is it some kind of way of instructing people about past events? I don't know. Future generations are going to eventually figure this out. And that's my time theory. Basically, I had a few other points to make with it. And that's how I came to that conclusion. Now, the future is more of an interesting concept. Now, we get into this whole idea recently, which is being discussed in certain circles, called mimicking. Whether these future jumps are mimicking us, or we are mimicking them. That is a very good question, which I don't think is going to be answered by my generation. So future generations, you're going to answer this question. Could it be possible, applying the same theory that I have for linear and nonlinear time and past events, to go to the future events and kind of ask the question, could they be observing our world to such an extent that when we jump to the future, they say to you, I'm from your future, and this is going to be your future. I have the new cell phone right here, and it's got all these new features, and here, I'll give you one, and this is from the future, and you use it, but I want you to patent that for me, and I want to split the dividends with you. Since them being an advanced civilization. Now, here's what this whole convincing goes on. And I think that's what it's about, traveling from the past to the future. Go ahead.
Bernie, thank you so much for your time today, man. It's been very, very interesting. And I hope people will take this interview as part of their big goodie bag of research upon which they should basically do further research at bernardmendez.com and UFOQ&A, that's A&D, .com. Bernie, thank you so much.
Been a pleasure.
All right, we'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Archives will be up at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, americanfreedomradio.com, guerrillamedia.co.nz, and also on my YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media. We had a webcam with Bernie today, so it'll be a very good video. Join us in the social chat in just a few minutes.